Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano, producer for the show here, filling in for Cy Kellett as he makes his way around beautiful, snowy South Dakota. So say a prayer for him as he bundles up and warms up because his San Diego blood is quite thin out there. But for today's show, we have two full hours with Joe Heschmar. He is the host of the Shameless Popery podcast, along with author of a gang of books, including the newest, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. Well, if you have a question for Joe, you can go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH. It's an Ask Me Anything Day with Joe. How are things on the Shameless front, or the Shameless Popery front, shall I say?
I'm happy. I did episodes recently on baptism, and I've got an episode coming up tomorrow on the lazy dogmatism of Sam Harris. So if you're familiar with Sam Harris, he was one of the so-called four horsemen of new atheism. And he is on this constant kick about how religious people are just led by dogma and not reason. And you can tell this because they don't have falsifiable claims. And none of that is right. And his idea of falsification is coming from a thinker by the name of Karl Popper. And Popper, actually, in the book in question, talks about how not to understand things. And it's exactly all the things Sam Harris is doing. And so Popper, back in 1959, accused thinkers very much like Sam Harris of a sort of intellectual laziness and of having this kind of dogma where only science was true. And it's really startling to see someone, from half a century, more than half a century at this point ago, correctly diagnosing so many things that the modern world is getting wrong. And it's thought that it's hopefully, it was fun for me to make, hopefully it's fun for other people to consume tomorrow, to just think about, like, oh yeah, this is exactly the kind of error that is very widespread in the modern world, of imagining faith is just irrational belief and that we need to just have the facts and that these are just things we can find and empirically test. And that's not how real life works at all. That is a small part of certain parts of the natural sciences. That is not the way anyone, believer or non-believer, lives their life, because that's an absurd vision of reality.
Do you find that mindset is still fairly prevalent and still growing in the world today? Or do you think that's kind of an idea that's starting to go away and other arguments are coming up?
Yeah, okay, that's a very good question. So the thing that got me to make this response video was a thing he did for the YouTube channel Big Think, and that had like 500,000 views in like 4 days. So it's not fringe. It's not obscure. I do see some signs. You know, I think the new atheists are increasingly kind of gauche. They're out of date. They're kind of cringy. It's, you know, the neck-bearded guy with a fedora who is doing the actually. And I think increasingly even other non-religious people look at that and roll their eyes and realize that there's something kind of pathetic. This is not the bold and exciting stance it might have seemed to be in 2004. This is something where it's like, if you're still making the same arguments 20 years later, as Sam Harris is, and people have responded to them and you've ignored all of those responses for 20 years, as if you haven't noticed them, you are not a brilliant intellectual. You're just not. Like, that is not how an authentic intellectual navigates in any kind of discipline. And so I think the idea that, like, okay, go back 20 years, and it's fair to say there were a lot of outspoken, kind of ignorant Christian voices. And then you had these scientists who came in and said, actually, and it did look like a David and Goliath kind of situation. But now there are a lot of brilliant, outspoken Christians or people who are maybe adjacent to Christianity who really reject everything that the new atheists have been peddling. And the new atheists haven't done any of the intellectual work to kind of respond to those arguments. So they don't seem to understand philosophy or formal logic or any of these things. And it's no longer the impressive David and Goliath situation that they might have found themselves in, again, at this point, almost a quarter century ago.
Wasn't Richard Dawkins one of those four horsemen?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and didn't he recently say something about the world needs Christianity and or in not so many words?
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating thing. Dawkins hates the truth claims of Christianity. But this is one of the things that they were completely just look, the four horsemen of the New Atheism, and more broadly, a lot of the leading lights of New Atheism, are people who, by and large, understand certain sciences very well, but are clueless about the way the world actually works in basically any discipline outside of science. They're not well-read. They're not deeply versed in philosophy. They don't know history. And so they imagined, very naively, that they could just fight to push Christianity out, and that therefore people would become very rational, non-dogmatic sort of thinkers. No one who understands human psychology or has read any of history is going to lead to that kind of conclusion. And it isn't as if after you have the French Revolution in, what is that, 1789, that you then have this great era of peace. No, when you create those kind of vacuums, intellectually, power vacuums, whatever it is, what happens isn't the rise of brilliant, you know, above sinfulness kind of free thinking. No, what happens is something else fills the void. In the French Revolution case, it's a guy by the name of Napoleon. In the American political scene, I think you could argue everything from wokeism to Trumpism has rushed into this space that was vacated in large part by Christianity. And I don't say that as just like an indictment. I mean, like, people want a creed. They want something to believe in, and they'll find it somewhere. And the new atheists thought that they could just say, like, science, and that was going to be a satisfactory kind of creed. But for anyone who has a rich interior life of any kind, just knowing how particles work is not going to satisfy the deeper questions of life. And so, ironically, this is one of the things Karl Popper warned against in 1959, that the people who think that the sciences are all there is tend to not understand why any of those other questions matter, like what the meaning of life is, and they treat them like pseudo questions because they're not questions they know how to answer. And that's exactly what the new atheists did. Like, why would you ask where the universe came from? Why would you ask what life's meaning is? And it's like, no, that is not intellectually satisfying, not just not spiritually satisfying. Like, that is an intellectual cop-out. And I think people have responded to that.
Well, there you have it. You got a little glimpse of Shameless Popery podcast. So if you have a little desire to dig deeper, make sure you check that out. Shameless Popery, shamelessjoe.com. And you can also check out his YouTube channel. Just type in Shameless Popery there. That's the visuals are great. So his podcast producer is doing a great job on that front. So with that, we do have a couple lines open. If you want to ask Joe a question, you can call us at 888-318-7884. With that, we go to Levi in Virginia, watching on Catholic.com. Levi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Peace be with you.
And with your spirit.
With your spirit.
All right. First of all, I just want to say, Joe, thank you for all of your work, because my question has to do with one of your pieces of work.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Although it's not an episode of the acclaimed podcast Shameless Popery, which you guys can find episodes for every Tuesday and Thursday on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts.
There you go. Clip that out.
Short episode on Tuesday. Gets
there
a long,
you go. I don't even need to do it anymore. I love it.
Okay. But Joe, your work, as well as a lot of other works in the Catholic sphere, have really impacted me as somebody who was pretty much born and raised into a good Baptist family. Mm-hmm. Although I would consider myself to be, and this is my own terminology, a de jure Baptist and not a de facto one.
Uh-huh. I appreciate primarily that very nerdy distinction. Yeah.
Okay, well, a lot of this comes from the fact that by the grace of God, through a lot of your work, I have come to accept more and more of the dogmas and specific claims of the Catholic Church. For instance, infant baptism, baptism mm-hmm. regeneration, as well as, you know, the case for the sacraments as well. But here is where we get to the tricky part. You wrote an article that was titled Avoid Converting to Save Relationships. And this kind of ties into my question. Although I have not fully decided on whether or not, mm-hmm. oh, hey, the Catholic Church is, you know, where it's at, you know, the truth of the matter is I've pretty much been born and raised in a good Baptist family. And, you know, a lot of this kind of view of Christianity is what I've grown up and raised around. You know, the idea of just leaving that behind and, you know, kind of making this big thing is just kind of scary, if not almost a little bit like you're betraying people, you know. So I just, the situation is really my question.
Yeah, well, first of all, praise God for your openness, because it's very clear that you're someone who's been seeking spiritually, and it seems like the Lord has been responding to that in beautiful and gracious ways. And I'm very grateful for any role I've played kind of on that journey. This is one of those questions where I think Jesus has hard words, and I'm going to give Jesus's words and then add a few of my own. So in Luke 12, Jesus says, beginning in verse 49, I came to cast fire upon the earth and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how I am constrained until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, but rather division. For henceforth in one house there will be five divided, three against two and two against three. They'll be divided, father against son, and son against father, mother against daughter, and daughter against her mother, mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. So I started that to say, we have to be willing to follow Jesus in the way that he is calling us to follow him, even if that causes some ripples in the family. And that's something that, as a Catholic, you have to do. You know, that, for instance, you might have a case where a young man discerns that God is calling him to discern the priesthood, and he's the only son in the family. This is not my own story, by the way. He's the only son in the family, and mom really wants grandkids, and, you know, dad wants the name carried on. And so there's a lot of pressure put on him not to go into seminary. You find this even amongst Catholics, and you have to be willing to take the stand, even if you know it might cause some pain in the family. Or you have a case where you say, I can't in good conscience go to this wedding because I don't think it's a real wedding. And I know this is going to cause a real problem in my relationship with my sister. And I don't want that. I love my sister. But I'm going to follow Jesus in the way I believe he's calling me, even if it comes at a certain cost. So this is one thing Jesus is very clear about in following him. Now, having said that, if I may, I'd like to speak a few words into the situation you find yourself in. Most of evangelicalism is not counter to Catholicism. Like, if you think about it, if you're coming from a different religion and you believed in false gods or something like this, then it's true. You would have to abjure those false gods and say, I don't believe in Baal anymore. I believe in God. But in the case of evangelicalism, even though we often focus on where we differ, and, you know, I certainly do this as well, partly to show the distinctive nature of Catholicism, the reality that we don't want to miss is there is this common love of God, a common love of Jesus, a common belief in the Trinity. And so there is much that is true, good, and beautiful in evangelical Protestantism, which, by the way, it has gotten from Catholicism. The things we differ about are those elements of Protestantism that are very young, and those things you can reject without rejecting all of the good stuff. There's a great book by a Protestant-turned-Catholic priest by the name of Louis Boyer, B-O-U-Y-E-R, I think it is, called The Spirit and Forms of Protestantism. And he makes the case that there's a lot of vibrant spiritual life in Protestantism, but that if you trace it back, you realize that these are things that they inherited from their Catholic ancestry. So it's not a matter of rejecting your evangelical roots. I would suggest it's a matter of digging even deeper and finding that everything good in your evangelical roots was itself rooted in Catholicism, was itself something that, you know, Protestants didn't just invent or create, but something that they preserved and maybe cultivated from their Catholic heritage. Does that make sense, Levi?
Yes, it does.
All right. Great. All right, Levi, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go ahead and leave that right there because we have to go to our first break. So there's going to be one line open. So if you want to go ahead and give us a call and talk to Joe, we have 2 full hours, so there's going to be plenty of time to talk to him. So go ahead and give us a call at 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Agnes of Rome. She was a teen or tween when she refused a marriage proposal. She could not marry because she had consecrated herself to Jesus. Her jilted suitor denounced her as a Christian, and she was condemned. Agnes's courage in facing death was a major factor in the conversion of Rome.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything, Catholicism edition, because what else would it be on Catholic Answers Live, right? So we're here with Joe Heschmeyer doing these 2 full hours, and we're going to go back to the calls because there's plenty to go through. We go to Audrey in Denver, Colorado, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Audrey, welcome to the show. You are live with Joe Heschmeyer.
Thank you so much for taking my call. So before I get to my question, I had a proposal for your next fundraising campaign.
Okay.
A couple years ago, Joe, you mentioned on an Ask Me Anything for RCIA that you don't have to go through Catholic Jeopardy in order to enter the Catholic Church. But I think that would actually be a fantastic fundraising idea for you guys. Have
Catholic Jimmy Jeopardy?
Aiken play Alex Trebek and you and friends and pick your favorite third.
I'll tell you, my favorite part of this is that Jimmy is playing Alex Trebek, so no one has to play against him, because I think the rest of us would be at a serious disadvantage. I don't think anyone would be offended by me saying his knowledge of trivia, of all stripes, but especially Catholic trivia, is impressive.
But my actual question was, what is your favorite Advent tradition and why?
Oh, gosh. I love
Advent. As a shameless papist.
Plug.
I love Advent. It's one of those seasons that's so short where it feels like once I'm really experiencing it, it's over. And maybe that's one of the things I like about it. But it's such a beautiful spirit of preparation. And so especially with kids, the thing, my wife has been very good about this, is doing Advent candles. And I would suggest anyone listening now, start looking for Advent candles right now. They are weirdly hard to find, and you might have to go online because, like, I naively thought I could just go to Walmart or something. And instead, you get these, like, so-called Advent calendars that are actually just the calendar of the first 25 days of December. And it's like, what if Advent isn't December 1st to the 25th? What do you do then? It's like Advent calendars by people who don't know what Advent is. It's painful. So we do a combination of things. We do a little Advent wreath with the Advent candles. And so then we gather around in the evening and the kids get to help light the candles, which they really like. And then we say a few prayers. And then at the end, my wife always has us get the Trader Joe's Advent calendar, which I think also has often the wrong number of days, but has chocolate. So then we open that up and let the kids split one of the little chocolates. So it's, you know, they're not indulging so much that it ruins the preparatory nature of it, but it does make them really look forward to, we're kind of bribing them into prayer, probably. Once I say it out loud, it's like, oh yeah, there's a little bit of bribery there, but they love it. It's something they look forward to. They get chocolate and fire and a time to pray together. So it's a really beautiful, serene kind of moment in the evening. And I've got a, you know, 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. So beautiful and serene are not always the ways I describe the period right before bed. So I have some ulterior motives, perhaps, but those are my favorite traditions there.
How's that, Audrey?
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for asking that. Yeah. I'm going to give you my 2 cents, too, because why not?
Yeah, please. The Hispanic... I almost asked Audrey, but I didn't know if it was going to take the whole thing in a totally different direction.
I would say if you live in an area where there's a lot of Hispanics, make sure you join the tradition of posadas. They're a lot of fun, especially during Advent. Yeah.
Remind me what this is. I've heard of this. I don't know what it is.
So it's in preparation for the coming of Jesus, obviously, for Advent. But they do gatherings at different homes throughout Advent. Typically you see them on weekends. Sometimes you'll see them during the weekdays. But it's you go to somebody's house, and then there's like a little back and forth between Jesus and Mary looking for a place to stay, you know, stay at the end. And then it becomes like this little celebration. Kids are involved. They tend to dress up. And then there's a Mexican sweet bread and, you know, chocolate. And it just becomes a really fun tradition and just kind of the anticipation for Christmas. So it's always fun. So if you live in an area with a lot of Hispanics, go to your parish, talk to them, because I know a lot of times they'll talk about them where they're going to do the next one. So highly
That's
recommend
awesome.
That.
Is that a specifically Mexican or all kind of Latin American?
I don't know. I know the Mexicans do it. I don't know what the rest do. So I'll leave it at that.
See, if you group all Latin Americans as Mexican, you get away with it. But if I do it.
That's true.
Okay. It says, I just looked on Wikipedia, El Salvador, Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras. And then I didn't click on the link.
Perfect.
So it looks like, at least Mexico and Central America.
Perfect.
If I can add one more tradition.
Go for it.
One thing that a lot of people do wrong, so this is my chance to get up on my soapbox a little bit. When you make the nativity scene, don't put Jesus in the manger yet. So prepare the entire nativity scene and then leave the middle empty to remind us that we're waiting for Jesus. Now, what some people do as well is they'll have the wise men off, you know, maybe somewhere else in the room where they're coming from afar, and people who are really ambitious and are better at remembering to do things every day will even move them a little bit every day. That is not where we are in our life right now, because things we just leave out get moved around or destroyed. What I have found on a very practical level, Fontanini is a brand of Italian nativity scenes that they do wax resin that look nice, and they're very durable. So if they get, for instance, dropped, or if the animals start fighting, if you have, for instance, a 3-year-old boy, they can put up with a fair amount of stress, we'll say.
Perfect. All right, Audrey, thank you so much for your question. From there, we're going to go to anonymous caller in Illinois watching on Catholic.com. Welcome to the show, Anonymous.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, Is it okay to listen to music that have like a theme of loneliness? I can't even say that word either. We're on the same boat, but
right.
loneliness.
Yeah. So this is a good question, because we should when we're considering any kind of music. Sometimes people will think about just the lyrics, but the structure of the music itself has this incredible role that it plays on the soul, and this is something that was recognized by both the ancient Greeks, figures like Plato, but also by the early Christians. So like St. Basil talks about this. This is one of the reasons, by the way, for the Psalms. He explains that this is like one of the ways God is communicating things to us with like this music, that we can better internalize these things. So what we should take away from that is music has this incredible power that goes beyond where logic can go. That when you think about a logical argument, you hear the argument and you can kind of logically analyze the different parts of it and say, I agree with that or I don't agree with that. Well, the way music works tonally is it reaches to the level of the soul sort of directly. And so you can find like children, even pre-verbal infants who are moved to tears by these hauntingly beautiful songs, or you'll hear a song in another language that maybe you don't speak at all. You know, the Dies Irae has this power to move you, even if you don't know what the words mean. O Fortuna, you know, there's any Cucurucucu Paloma in Spanish. I mean, I didn't know what that meant. Turns out it's just the sound a dove makes. And those kind of songs have this incredible pull on the soul, even if you don't understand them lyrically. So we should take that very seriously and recognize that can be good or bad. Now, all of the emotions are gifts from God. Anger is a gift. Loneliness is a gift. These things, as strange as that is to say, all of the emotions, like the whole realm of emotional palette, is something that is God-given, but it can be distorted, and you have to respond to certain emotions, especially strong and seemingly negative emotions, in a proper way. And that proper way isn't just bottling them up, but it's also not just dwelling on them. And so when you're feeling really bad, sometimes you want to listen to music just to feel worse about yourself, and I would be very cautious about that. Other times, maybe hearing something sad actually helps bring you out of it, because it's almost like you've found a little bit of empathy. Someone else has met your experience, and you feel a little less alone in the world. So I would suggest, with any of this music, be aware lyrically and structurally, what's its impact on your soul? What is it doing to you?
All right, Anonymous, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. Go ahead and give us a call back whenever you have another question for us. And we'll be right back right after this break with Joe Heschmeyer.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
From its earliest days, Catholic faith has been lived by a yearly cycle of feasts and seasons. The new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, Feasts of Our Fathers, is a one-stop companion for praying and meditating through the holy days and seasons of the church with help from the most ancient Christian people. Don't just read about the early saints, pray with them. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers now at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. My name is Edgar Lujano. I'm filling in for Cy Kellett. I'm the one of the CA producers here for the live show. So if you ever call us, you're usually talking to me before I let you through with Cy and Joe and Jimmy and whoever else is on. But today, I fill in. And just with me, next to me, is another person who tends to fill in for the show. Thomas, what's up?
You all thought you were rid of me, but I came back for one last little segment on this show.
Just need to seep over from yesterday, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I had to keep on creeping onto this auditory airspace.
But today you wear a different hat.
I do.
Quite a TikTok literally. Hat.
Quite literally, I wear the beanie, which I'm only allowed to wear as Thomas the TikTok Engine. But, you know, that's fine. I'm all for ritual and decor that's appropriate to the
tradition.
Setting. Exactly. Okay. Another reason for you to watch the show, if you don't already, by the way, just to see, like, which Thomas is in the studio today.
There you go. Right?
Well, and also to see what Joe's wearing, because I'm not going to describe it to you. You just got to see it for yourself. It's quite tremendous.
Yeah, if you're on the app or in your car listening to the radio, make sure you go back to the YouTube channel and look at his shirt. It's something.
Not while you're driving.
not while you're driving. For more reasons than one, it will probably cause you to crash.
Exactly. All right, go ahead.
All right. Now that we're done pushing the YouTube channel so hard, Joe, the TikTok question I brought for you today, This person says, why didn't Jesus explain exactly how things should be instead of speaking in parables? Explaining clearly would have, I think, eliminated all of these other religions.
I would respond to that by saying there are plenty of times where Jesus speaks pretty plainly and pretty directly, and we still see other religions. I mean, there are plenty of times where, for instance, the Catholic Church has applied Jesus's teaching in explicit, direct sort of ways, and we still see other religions. So I don't think Jesus not using parables would have gotten rid of other religions. I don't think that's why people reject his teachings or misunderstand him. But why then does he speak in parables? I think part of that gets to the heart of what it is Jesus is doing. The point of Christianity is not just to have new information, and the point of God coming into the world isn't just to provide new data. He could do that any number of ways. It's much more relational, and what he's seeking from us isn't just knowledge, which is the point of sharing data. He's seeking a relationship, which is where faith comes in. And so the way the parables work, it's brilliant, because if you don't love him, if you don't trust him, if you're not going to give him the benefit of the doubt, if you're not going to take him seriously, you can hear the parable and get nothing out of it. But if you're willing to throw yourself at his feet, throw yourself upon him, trust him completely, and try to learn and listen from him, sit at his feet, right, then you'll find endless numbers of teaching that you couldn't just summarize in one sentence. Like the number of times you might hear the same parable, say, you know, the parable of the talents, and you get something new and rich out of it that you didn't get before, that you're not going to be able to do that by just giving, you know, 10 commandments about the talents. It doesn't work like that. That rather, this is a perennial source that the more you devote yourself to him, the more you grow both in the relationship and in the knowledge. So it's a pretty brilliant way that he presents the faith.
Great. Thanks a lot, Joe. I'll throw back on TikTok, and I hope they keep coming back to it and digging more and more riches out of that answer.
I should have given it in the story instead.
Yeah. Tell us a story about your kids next time.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thanks, Thomas. Thanks for joining.
Appreciate that.
All right. We're going to go back to the phones because there's plenty of people on the line. All the lines are full, which is always a good sign. Christine in Las Vegas, Nevada, watching on YouTube. Christine, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
So, Joe, my question is, there's a lot of self-help books out there about negative thinking and negative thought patterns, and it's from, like, your subconscious and how you grew up and how it affects you in your life and how successful you are. And I'm wondering if those who are, like, in a state of sin, are they more affected by negative thoughts than people who are in a state of grace? And, like, how are there resources out there, like, from our faith that talk about subconscious minds? And do they go together, or is it just spiritual with us?
I see.
Sorry, I can't articulate it better. But
No, I think you've articulated it pretty well. So is it the sort of the self-tearing down sort of thoughts? Is that what you mean by negative thoughts? Because, I mean, negative thoughts could mean a number of things. Like, it could mean, like, sinful desires, or it could mean something like, you're not good enough, you're not worthwhile. What kind of thing do you have in mind?
Yeah, like, thoughts of, like, you're not good enough, and, you know, you, like, paralyzing, where you don't go out, take risks, or you don't achieve goals, and you're so down on yourself, and then, you know, relationships in the future, how you grew up and how you saw your parents, and it kind of just trickles down and into your life, and you're perpetuating the same relationships, which you don't want to sabotage.
Yeah. You've given me a very clear example, and I think you've given me a good kind of doorway to the situation too, because a lot of what's coming in there is sort of the role of what we call family of origin. Like, what were your parents like? What was your family dynamic like when you were growing up? Because a lot of what you learn about how to operate in the world, you're getting at a very young age. And so if you saw dysfunctional ways of operating, and I won't ask you to share anything too personal on the air, but if you saw dysfunctional ways of operating, you learned the wrong way to do it. In the same way that if, let's say, you had parents who had terrible grammar, you might struggle your whole life with conjugating sentences because in your formative years, you learn it wrong and have to constantly correct yourself. I didn't get the E and the I vowel sounds. I think I've only got myself to blame there, but I was kid number four, so people tease me because I pronounce the word U-N-T-I-L like I-N-T-E-L. So I say until, and it's, you know, my mom, dad's from Alabama, so there's maybe a little bit of that in there. Those kind of things at a very simple level. We can think about any number of things where you say, oh, I know why I did that. I did that because of my experience in childhood. And there's probably way more things than that that we don't even know about. Well, spiritually, that plays a role as well, because if you were formed in a way where you interact badly with the world around you, or you were formed in such a way that you emerged with this sense of your own worthlessness, that can be something that haunts you in an ongoing sort of way, and that has to be healed. That's not just a spiritual problem. Like, there's a psychological thing going on there, and it certainly has spiritual implications, right? The devil is the enemy of human nature. That's what St. Ignatius calls him. And the enemy of human nature, he hates us. He hates that God made us, and he wants us to feel really cruddy about ourselves. God never wants that. He may want our conversion. He may want us to stop doing certain things, but look at the way Jesus approaches sinners with this gentleness and compassion. He approaches them with this tremendous sense that he loves them and sees value in them even at their worst. In contrast, even if you're not in sin, the devil will try to tell you, well, you're not good enough. You're not brave enough. You're not this enough. You're not your neighbor enough. You're not somebody else enough. And will constantly try to tear you down for that. And that is a voice to recognize and resist. Because you recognize it to say, okay, that is not coming from God. If there's one verse I would give you, it's John 14:27, where Jesus says, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give peace to you. Nor let your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid. So earlier in this hour, I shared where Jesus talked about how he came not to bring peace but the sword. And you might say, well, how could those two things both be true? Because he doesn't come to give like worldly peace where it's the peace of indifference. You know, you just live and let live by sacrificing your principles, or the peace of domination where the weak are under the strong. No, Christ's peace is something else. It's a rightly ordered peace where everything and everyone is where they ought to be. And so allowing yourself to see yourself more the way Jesus sees you and to be loved in the way that Jesus loves you can be a good first step towards healing those things. I would be remiss as the husband of a marriage and family therapist not to also mention that things like therapy and EMDR kind of therapies in particular can be really effective in helping people break free sometimes from old wounds, maybe wounds they weren't even aware of how much of a role they had. And then finally, in terms of spiritual resources, there's a lot of good resources out there. Maybe a nice short thing would be Father Jacques Philippe has a whole series of works, and he talks a lot about interior freedom and about peace and these good themes that might help you reclaim your sense as a beloved daughter of God.
Thank you so much.
Is that helpful, Christine? Yeah.
Yes, I have a lot of Father Jacques Philippe's books already.
Oh, good. Well, the other book I was thinking about, but I don't know if it's too... Well, I'm not sure if it's quite on point, but The Fire Within by Father Thomas Dubé is another one that I think is quite good. It's a spiritual treatise, but it talks at one point, discerning the psychological from the spiritual, and it has some good tools in there, but I'm really recommending like 5% of the book, and I'm not sure if the other 95% would really be on point. So do with that, I guess, what you will.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for your call, Christine. Really appreciate that. We're going to go ahead to our last break of the hour. And when we come back, we'll go through the rest of the calls because the lines continue to stay full. I'm not going to give the number out because, like I said, they're full. So we'll be right back after this break.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul Street Evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is the Catholic Sportsman Show. Randy and Paul discuss professional, college, and youth sports topics from our Catholic Christian perspective. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Catholic Answers Live. As you know, for the last, I think, few weeks, we've been pitching our Catholic Answers calendar, the 2025 calendar. So we've been highlighting a different artist every single day. Today, we're going to highlight November's image, which is the image is Christ the King by Gwyneth Thompson Briggs. She's a contemporary sacred artist in the perennial Western tradition. She is dedicated in particular to reviving techniques from the Renaissance and Baroque eras to reveal the glory of God in the midst of today's crisis. Her art decorates churches, schools, private homes throughout the Americas and Europe. So if you want your copy of the Catholic Answers calendar, make sure you go to Catholic.com. There's an orange banner at the top of the page, and you should be able to get it. So go ahead and check that out. All right, Joe, shall we jump back in?
Yeah, please.
All right. We go to our friend Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Two of my favorite people, Edgar and Joe.
Make sure you say that when Cy is on, okay?
I will.
When he has somebody besides me on, you should be like, you know who two of my favorite people are? Edgar and Joe. He'll love it.
That's right.
He'll love it.
All of a sudden.
Don't quote me on that.
All of a sudden. Just like that. Okay, do we have any idea what it means when Gabriel told Mary that the Spirit of God would overshadow her?
We do. I'm very glad you asked that.
Oh, you do?
Yes. So, first, when we talk about overshadowing, the Greek word being used there is the same Greek word used, well, on the one hand, when St. Peter's shadow falls on people and heals them in Acts 5, but it's also the Greek word used in two other contexts that are really fascinating. One, the overshadowing cloud in the Transfiguration in Mark 9, but then the parallel passages of the Transfiguration as well. But more interestingly, in the Greek translation of Exodus 40. So the overshadowing, so in the Transfiguration, just to clarify that, you have the cloud, which is how the Holy Spirit is presenting himself. And you have the voice, which is the Father. And then you have Christ in glory. So it's this Trinitarian vision. Well, him going up the mount with the two disciples very much also looks like Moses going up the mount to meet God, except here what they're seeing isn't that this is a great prophet who speaks face to face with God, but that he's that and is also God himself. So there's a whole beautiful thing going on there with the Transfiguration. But the cloud recalls Exodus, because remember, in the Exodus, the Israelites were led by a pillar of cloud. And so there is this whole motif of the pillar of cloud leading the Israelites through the Red Sea and the parting of the Red Sea. In 1 Corinthians 10, St. Paul describes this as baptism into Moses, because it's water plus the Holy Spirit, which are the two ingredients of baptism. But the last place that we see this overshadowing word is in the Greek translation, as I said, of Exodus 40. In Exodus 40, when talking about the Ark of the Covenant, it says in verse 29 that there was an overshadowing of the Ark. And so this is one of the things, when we talk about Mary being the Ark of the New Covenant, the way that she is described, that the Holy Spirit overshadows her, and this is where the conception of Jesus comes from, is very much the way the presence of the Lord is described in the Ark of the Covenant, where there is this spiritual overshadowing. And that becomes clearer, as I say, in the Septuagint, the Greek translation, because it's the same Greek word being used in both cases. Does that help?
Good. Yeah, that's excellent. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Sure thing. Well, thanks for your call, Emma.
Here.
Yeah, you too.
Bye. Yeah,
you bet.
Thank you so much. With that, we go over to Michael in Buffalo, New York on YouTube. Michael, go right ahead.
I can't talk to someone from Buffalo this week. It's too painful.
It's too painful. It hurts too much, Buffalo.
As a Chiefs fan, yeah. No, go ahead. Sorry, Michael.
Michael, you might hurt his feelings a little bit, but we're going to let you on. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Joe, I actually met you a few years ago here in Buffalo at Our Lady of Victory Basilica at the Catholic
it's
Answers booth.
Beautiful church, by the way, which I was stunned by. I was not expecting that level of beauty.
It is. Well, I have a few questions for you. I'm a catechist here in Buffalo, and we often get Protestants that are converting. And when it comes to certain objections, we get to a point where we'll start talking about the early church and what we believe now was believed in the early church. And often we'll get resistance when it comes to proving the papacy, where the line after Peter, from Peter to the line right after that, it can't be proven that it was Catholic. Oh, and then I'll often get objections that the Catholic Church was corrupted at the First Council of Nicaea. How would you explain that to a Protestant, that what we believe now was what the earliest church fathers believed?
Well, I don't know if you intended this or not, but I'm going to make sure if you stay on the line, you get a copy of my book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, because I have a book-length answer to that question. But the short form is, we know from early Christian writings what the early Christians believed. Many, not just many Protestants, many Americans more broadly, have this vague sort of understanding that, like, oh yeah, everything was super disorganized, and there were all of the, you know, people were just kind of doing their own thing, they're reading the Bible, and they have these very specific kind of visions of what early Christianity was like. And you ask them, like, well, what is that based on? Like, show me a document that points to that. And it's not. It's just based on these kind of vibes or this kind of cultural knowledge that somebody told them that and somebody had told them that and so on. And it's not really rooted in anything. And then you go and read the early Christians and you're like, oh, wow. No, they're incredibly, incredibly Catholic. You know, you say, take St. Justin Martyr from about 160. And he writes about the structure of the Mass, and you can read that as a Catholic and say, yep, we still do that, we still do that, we still do that. This thing might be in a different place, we still do that. You know, the sign of peace might be in a different spot. Yeah, this is clearly the Mass. And so you look at those things and you think, okay, clearly. Or go 20 years later to the year 180, Irenaeus of Lyon writing in Against Heresies, when he traces who every pope was down to Eleutherius, who was pope in 180. And it's just like, okay, it's right there. This wasn't something they were just making up a minute ago. They are saying, we got this stuff from the apostles. And they're just preserving it. So that leaves us with two possibilities. Either on the one hand, the earliest known Christians outside the Bible were not reliable witnesses that could be trusted. And if that's true, we're in trouble, because those are the same people who tell us which books are in the Bible. Or the earliest known witnesses outside the Bible can be trusted. That doesn't mean they couldn't get this or that wrong, but we largely can trust them as preservers of the truth. And therefore, when they tell you the apostles taught this thing, it's pretty good evidence that the apostles taught that thing. And then the last thing I'd say is, in Matthew 13, in the parable of the mustard seed, Jesus talks about the kingdom of God as a mustard seed that grows into a mustard tree. So that means when you're looking for the kingdom of God on earth, we should be looking, or kingdom of heaven, it's presented in Matthew's gospel, the kingdom of heaven on earth. You shouldn't be trying to artificially recreate your idea of what the first century church was like, that's just based on kind of a vague sense from the Acts of the Apostles or from a show you watched. You should be saying, where in history do we see what Jesus starts through the apostles, and how does that grow and mature for 2,000 years, and where can I find that? And if you take that question seriously, and you really start to say, like, where did the church founded by Jesus end up? I don't think you stay Protestant very long when you actually do that digging.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. Like I said, stay on the line, and we'll get you a copy of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a huge compliment, because you being in Buffalo and him giving you a book, that's like an olive branch.
We already gave you a W, now you're going to get a book as well.
There you go. So. The olive branch has been extended. All right, Michael, stay on the line, and we'll go ahead and get you that book. We move over to, well, you know what? We're going to stay in New York just for you, Joe. We're going to Thomas in New York watching on YouTube. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Actually, not just from New York, also from Buffalo.
Beautiful.
I think the two of you, that counts as a herd, right?
I know. I was lost for a second there. I thought they just got my name wrong. God bless you, Joe. I'm a big fan of the podcast, but I kind of want to move quickly on this question. It's a little bit deeper. Revolves around the Olivet discourses. So particularly in Mark 13, it's a little bit deeper because I already know, obviously the controversy around this generation, stuff like that, already have some answers to that, particularly, generally the best one that I found is that we kind of affirm a partial preterism. He's talking here about the destruction of the temple, but really this is a type for the end of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, that's cool. That makes sense to me. Heard that, sat on it for a bit. My problem is you come across like parallel passages, for example, in Matthew 25:31. Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven coming in glory, right? Mm-hmm. This is the same language that we read about in Mark 13. So my question is, do I have to turn to someone, right? And I have to say, okay, well, here, in Mark 13, when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven coming with glory, really he's just talking about the temple. But here, in Matthew 25:31, when he's talking about the kingdom of heaven and glory, or coming in glory, he's talking about the end of the world. Because Matthew 25:31, is very obviously talking about the coming of the eschaton. That was my question. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so one of the things is that there is, if you will, a miniature judgment. There is sort of a judgment on Israel that's happening in 70 AD. And Jesus had foretold that this would happen. So if you go back to, for instance, Matthew chapter 15, when Jesus talks about the sign of, or no, Matthew 16, when Jesus talks about the sign of Jonah, and he says that an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign shall be given to it except for the sign of Jonah. Two things to pick up there. Jonah's message was 40 days hence, and Nineveh will be destroyed. And the generation that we talk about in Exodus was 40 years. So, sure. 40 years after Jesus says those words, you have the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which is, we totally underestimate the importance of that. We just think, the Jewish people were dispersed. But no, the temple is the visible place where heaven and earth meet. And so to have that shattered in this way is this divine judgment being visited in a way that is very hard to kind of shake when you understand temple theology. So what we see at 70 AD is a forerunner of what we will see in the last days, where there will be this great coming in glory. And you have even this separation, because if you remember Jesus' instructions, he tells them to flee to the hills. And so the Christians are spared the judgment. They're spared the destruction in 70 because Christ gave pretty specific warnings on that. So I think you see in that, if you want a dress rehearsal for the final judgment. And so tying that together, it makes sense that the language would have a parallel, because in both cases, you have a sort of apocalypse. You have a sort of end of the world event, because a world was brought to an end in a way that we don't appreciate. Like Second Temple Judaism, and even First Temple Judaism before it, is all centered around the temple. And that is irretrievably lost in a way it will never exist again. That's hard to even wrap our minds around. 70 AD is the end of the road for an entire religious system. There are still people who practice Judaism, but it looks markedly different after that, because the heart of it is now gone in the way that it hadn't been before. And I think we miss that because we don't have the same appreciation maybe for the temple.
All right, Thomas, thank you so much for your call. We're going to have to end it right there, unfortunately, because there is the music, and that's the end of the first hour. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. That's Ava, Katie, Chris, Hunter. Stay on the line. We definitely want to take your questions in the second hour. And we will be having one line open. So if you want to go ahead and give us a call, give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-31-TRUTH. And when we come back, it'll be a whole other hour of an Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer. We'll be right up.